Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump addressed the nation and the world today after Iran's missile attacks on two military bases in Iraq where American troops were stationed. He announced new sanctions against Iran, and he spoke directly to the Iranian people.
We want you to have a future, and a great future, one that you deserve, one of prosperity at home and harmony with the nations of the world. The United States is ready to embrace peace with all who seek it.
The Iranian strikes were in response to the U.S. killing of Iran's top military commander in Iraq last Friday. Today, Trump called General Qassem Soleimani the world's top terrorist. NPR's Jane Arraf is in Baghdad. And Jane, how are the president's remarks today being viewed there in Iraq?
Well, Tanya, there's kind of a sense of relief because he did not say he was going to retaliate against the strikes earlier today. And he actually said that he thought that Iran and the U.S. should cooperate on fighting ISIS and other areas of mutual interest. So the feeling was it could have been a lot worse. But essentially, people here were waiting to see what he would say about keeping U.S. troops here. And on that, there was absolutely nothing.
That's true. So a sense of relief, does it also feel like a sense of de-escalation?
It does a little bit, but not a long-term de-escalation, because Iran and the U.S. aren't the only players here in Iraq. There are the Iran-backed militias, for instance.
Yes, yes. I want to also ask you about something. Iran apparently notified the Iraqi government before its missile strikes. What does that say about Iran's intentions and really the relationship between those two countries?
Yeah, that was an interesting one. If you look at what the Iraqi prime minister actually said about that, he said that they received verbal notice from Iran just before or as Iran was starting those strikes. And Iran did not tell them where it was going to strike, but it did say it would be confined to U.S. bases. So it wasn't as if Iran was saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. Here's a heads up. This is where we're going to do it. They basically informed them that they were going to do it, and then, bam, there it was. Mm. It does show, though, that Iran does not want to totally alienate Iraq. In fact, Iraq today called the Iranian ambassador in and protested the breach of sovereignty. It's one of many breaches of sovereignty on both the Iraqi side and the Iranian side, most Iraqi officials feel, because Iraq has basically become a battleground for the two countries.
Yeah, yeah. Have any of the recent developments in the past day or so added support for what the Iraqi parliament did on Sunday, voting to call for the expulsion of American troops?
It has solidified support among the groups that already wanted U.S. troops to leave. There has been a long simmering discontent here with Iranian-backed groups in particular, but not all, who don't believe that U.S. forces should be here. There are a lot of others, and there are a lot of Iraqi officials who believe that Iraq would be in serious trouble if U.S. forces and coalition forces pulled out and they didn't have that help anymore. But the fact that we have now had here a drone strike that has killed a senior Iranian leader and a senior Iraqi leader, and then retaliatory strikes by Iran on what are essentially Iraqi bases with U.S. forces in them, that indicates to some politicians that it is just not worth having U.S. forces here. If they leave, then they would be less at risk.
Mm. I also want to ask you about damage there. President Trump said there were no American casualties in these Iranian strikes and only minimal damage. Do we know any more, though, about the effects of those strikes, whatever damage there might have been?
So that was the fascinating thing. Normally, with this number of rocket attacks, precision rocket attacks, one would think if they wanted to do serious damage, if they wanted to cause casualties, they would have. You know, almost every other day there's a rocket strike here by an Iran-backed militia that actually seemingly accidentally kills Iraqis. So this does seem to have been very deliberately conducted to minimize casualties and damage. Having said that, NPR has obtained satellite photos from one of the satellite photo agencies that show some of the damage at the Al-Asad airbase, the major airbase in western Anbar in the west of Iraq. And that actually shows quite serious damage to some of the facilities which had no people in them. So nothing catastrophic, and again, what seems to be an attack designed to spare casualties.
There's so much more here that we will be talking about over the next few hours and days. Thank you so much. That's NPR's Jane Arraf in Baghdad.
Thank you, Tanya.
Well, just hours after Iran launched those ballistic missiles against two bases in Iraq, a Ukrainian passenger plane bound for Kiev, Ukraine, crashed shortly after taking off from Tehran. Video from Iranian state media shows the plane descending, apparently on fire, and then crashing into a field and lighting up the dark sky before dawn. NPR has not independently verified that video, but Ukrainian officials say all 176 people on board, including Iranians and Canadians, were killed. Let's bring in here and now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. And Seth, what do we know about the last moments before this plane went down?
Not a lot yet, Jeremy. It happened suddenly, about a couple minutes into flight, plane climbing through 8,000 feet, lost contact with ground control, with the air traffic controllers there in Tehran. So no distress call. Something happened rather suddenly. Now, just because the pilots didn't communicate doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't dealing with something. The rule in the cockpit is aviate, navigate, and communicate in that order. So if you have to choose between trying to fix something and telling people about it, you try to fix it. But in any case, it seems to have happened rather quickly.
Well, if the video is correct and the plane was on fire before crashing, what could have possibly caused it to do that?
Right. And that video, as you said, unconfirmed, as well as video of the crash site, shows that the plane seemed to have gone down more or less intact. It didn't look, certainly from the video, like, let's say, a missile or something like that, although who knows. Well, Iranian officials initially said an engine fire, didn't provide any particular evidence or details about that. Ukrainian officials initially went along with that and seemed to rule out terrorism, let's say, but then kind of backed off that. They aren't saying it was something else, but they're no longer saying it wasn't. So sure, an engine fire, although things go wrong with engines all the time that don't bring planes down. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, some kind of terrorism on board, let's say an exploding device, you might picture the plane blowing apart, but and not crashing intact, but not necessarily. Somebody could blow a hole in the fuselage and cause a catastrophic damage that doesn't necessarily blow the plane apart, and it could crash intact. So still a lot left here. Obviously, this is all in the context of everything else going on in Iran, but it could just be a coincidence.
Well, it reminds me of that plane that crashed, the passenger plane that crashed in 2001 after 9/11 from JFK, but it had nothing to do with terrorism. It was completely unrelated.
Yeah, that's where all our minds went. I remember I was traveling at the time, and that's what everybody thought, and exactly ended up having nothing to do. It was American Airlines Flight 587.
Now, this plane that crashed in Tehran was a Boeing 737-800, not a Boeing 737 MAX, which is the one that's been grounded since the two crashes that killed hundreds of people. What more can you tell us about this particular aircraft that was involved in the crash?
Yeah, you're right, Jeremy. I think everybody at this point knows about the 737 MAX, but very few of us have actually ever been on one. Boeing just hadn't produced that many of them before the plane was grounded. The 737-800, on the other hand, almost every one of us has been on one. American, United, Delta, Southwest, and others, most major airlines fly these planes, fly lots of them, as well as similar versions, mechanically similar 700s and 900s that are just either bigger or smaller. This plane was rather new, joined Ukraine International's fleet back in 2016. And it was a new plane at that time. It's not as if they got it from somewhere else first.
And what kind of track record do they have, Ukraine International Airlines?
They've been flying since 1992, one of a handful of airlines that came about as the Soviet Union was crumbling in the ex-Soviet states. And they have a good safety record. They've actually never had any fatalities before this. It's an airline that meets that meets global standards, an airline that you or I would generally feel comfortable getting on.
Now, the black box is usually the piece of evidence investigators turn to figure out what happened after a crash. But an Iranian aviation official told a news agency that Iran is not going to send the flight data recorders to Boeing. The Iranian authorities did blame the crash on technical issues, though they didn't cite any evidence. How is this investigation going to play out if Iran's not going to send the black box to Boeing?
Yeah, going to play out differently from some others, but you know, not without precedent here. I mean, even look in Ethiopia, there was tension there about where the black boxes were going to go. They went in that case to France. Iran says it's providing information to the airline, so you have to figure that airline, Ukraine International, if it wants all the best information, could perhaps then share that with Boeing and with the National Transportation Safety Board and so forth in the U.S., even if it's not going directly there. But you're right, all of this getting caught up in global tensions, which you hate to see, because if there's something mechanical going on, everybody in the world would want to know about that, although way too early to say whether that is. And obviously very different implications for Boeing. There's no bringing back the 176 people no matter what, right. But if this was something mechanical versus terrorism.
That's Seth Kaplan here now, transportation analyst. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Planet Money is the mountaineer economist behind the carbon tax. It's the baseball player trying to get a pay raise. The prisoner building a blockchain out of cans of mackerel. Planet Money from NPR. Listen now.
It has been a week of fast-moving developments on Iran and impeachment, and it's only Wednesday. Let's bring in our political strategist, Jamal Simmons, Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And Matt Mikowiak, Republican. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
So this morning, President Trump said, as long as I'm president, Iran will never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. And then he said this about Iran's missile strikes yesterday on Iraqi bases where U.S. forces are stationed.
Our great American forces are prepared for anything. Iran appears to be standing down, which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world.
Matt, a question that a lot of very smart people have is what exactly is the president's strategy on Iran and what has he achieved? What do you think?
Well, I think maximum pressure is the strategy. It's actually not that different from the North Korea approach, although it's certainly different because you have regional partners in the Middle East and that have been brought to bear that are different from what you have in Asia. Look, this is an interesting and important chapter, I think, in the Trump presidency. To the extent you can, elucidate the Trump doctrine, I think it is that we are not going to sit back and let terrorists kill Americans, whether they be soldiers, whether they be contractors, whether they be diplomats, et cetera. And so the world is now on notice. Iran's on notice. Other foreign countries and terrorist organizations are on notice. Iran had an opportunity to continue their aggression against the United States, and they really didn't do that. I mean, this attack on the base was ultimately not meaningful in the sense that it didn't damage property and it didn't cost anyone their life on the U.S. or Iraqi side. And it appears that they gave Iraq a heads up, which presumably means they gave effectively the U.S. a heads up since the U.S. and Iraqi soldiers are stationed there together. So
they wanted to de-escalate,
I think the Trump doctrine
appears, right?
Effectively is if you kill an American soldier, we will respond very, very strongly. Outside of that, the president does not want to get into more foreign wars. And so he had an opportunity to sort of slap back at Iran and chose not to do that militarily. He showed restraint again today.
Jamal, how do you see it? And if Iran is now standing down, do you think the president played his cards right here?
The problem with Donald Trump from the very beginning is that the man is reckless. And it just does not seem as if he has many plans and strategies and he coordinates things with people. You know, being president is a hard job. I've been around two of them. It's a really tough job. And it seems as if the problem for Trump is that he's a little bit like this Bam Bam Rubble style of foreign policy where he just goes around banging his big club on the ground and expecting everybody to follow behind him. And I think while the Iranians seem to have backed off now, I hope that that is what is happening. I would not be surprised, though, if this is a feint maneuver, that this is if this is not exactly all they have up their sleeve and there's more to come. And we are being lulled a little bit by this particular kind of attack.
And Matt, as you look at the questions that are being asked right now in Washington, one of them is, what exactly was the intelligence that led to the killing of Soleimani? Because the administration has not come out and said, this is the attack we were trying to prevent, and this is why it was worth inflaming the tensions by killing Soleimani.
Yeah, I think, look, the administration is briefing the House and Senate intelligence committees today, this afternoon. So I imagine some word will creep out once those briefings are conducted. If you look carefully at what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said recently, it appears that Soleimani and his proxies were planning additional attacks on U.S. embassies or perhaps U.S. military installations in the region. So, look, the question of whether it was, quote, imminent or not is certainly in the mind of the person that's making up the decision. Does imminent mean today? Does it mean this week? Does it mean this month? I think ultimately the United States decided with the president's decision that taking Soleimani out would be good for national security. Look, there had to be a response to the attacks on the U.S. embassy in Iraq and to the death of the U.S. contractor. That was the aggression. That was the original aggression. Without those steps, I don't believe President Trump would have approved the strike on Soleimani. In fact, he had denied a request several months ago made by Secretary of State Pompeo to take out Soleimani. Mm-hmm. So that was the precipitating action that forced the president to make the decision he did. And it's a very good thing that the world's leading terrorist is no longer alive. I think all Americans should be able to celebrate that.
Jamal, what does this mean for the 2020 race? Bernie Sanders has stepped up his criticism of Joe Biden's vote for the Iraq War. Elizabeth Warren has been criticized by the left for calling Soleimani a murderer instead of a terrorist. And then, of course, Pete Buttigieg, Iraq War veteran, is he benefiting from this? How do you see this shaking up the race, if at all?
Well, what it's doing is highlighting the commander-in-chief part of the discussion, right? We're now in that part of the game. And so all these candidates need to belly up to the bar here and let us know as Americans, what is it that they'll do to protect us? What is their strategy on how to take the country forward and use our values in our foreign policy and not, again, be as reckless as Donald Trump, where he's trying to explain an attack, which maybe... Listen, nobody is defending Soleimani. He seems like a pretty dastardly guy by all accounts. The question, though, is killing a foreign government high-ranking official the proper response to the death of, you know, to the attack that came upon us? And perhaps there was something that would have been more proportionate and not risked us going into full-fledged war with one of the largest powers in the Middle East, which, of course, the United States would probably win that war in the hand-to-hand combat of the normal fighting. The question is, what would come after that? And we have not seen from this president the kind of diligence that we would look for. And secondly, we've also seen that the president is willing to use foreign policy for his own political needs. And we saw that in Ukraine. We've seen that in other places. So the question again is why and why now did Trump choose this course?
But who's looking best to you among the Democrats on the commander-in-chief
test?
Oh,
who's looking best? I think they all have to do better. This is my opinion about it. I think Joe Biden is the person you would assume is best, but he does have some troubling parts of his record that he's going to have to explain. Bernie Sanders seems to be incredibly dovish as a reaction. That doesn't impress me very much because I do think there are times when we need to use American power. And the others, I think, have to sort of explain to us what their approach is.
Okay, let's talk about impeachment. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is holding her cards close on when she will send the articles over to the Senate. She's asking Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to publish his rules for the trial first. He said he has the votes to start a trial without any agreement to call witnesses. Matt, where do you see this going at this point?
I'm amazed Pelosi didn't fold yesterday when the House came back. I think she'll fold this week. If you read between the lines, that's really the direction this is headed. In fact, senior senator from California, Democrat Dianne Feinstein, said she doesn't understand why Pelosi's delaying and what the benefit is. McConnell has the votes to move forward on the rules. This is the same rules package that was used in the Clinton impeachment. Look, the House can't dictate to the Senate. The Senate didn't even try to dictate to the House. The House ran its process. They believed it was an urgent matter. They couldn't give the White House due process. They couldn't wait for courts to rule on whether executive branch witnesses could use executive privilege to avoid testimony. So Pelosi's pocket veto not only makes no sense politically, but it makes no sense tactically. And if anything, it's putting pressure on the Democratic presidential candidates, five of whom are sitting United States senators, who want to be in Iowa and New Hampshire over the next 3 weeks, not in the United States Senate, sitting at their desk, you know, acting as a juror in a Senate trial. So I think she's going to fold this week. I'd be surprised if she didn't. You're starting to see Democratic senators speak out. She may be holding her cards close, but unfortunately, they're face up.
When do you think a trial will start, Matt?
I think soon. I mean, I think that all sides want it to be soon. I think the Senate wants to dispense with it, you know, reasonably quickly in a 2 to 3 week period. Both sides would present their case. Senators would be allowed to ask questions, and then there would be a vote on witnesses, mm-hmm. and that would be a 51 vote threshold. So I still think it's slated for this month. And in the meantime, all the Senate will do is pass the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement and continue confirming judges to lifetime appointments. So Pelosi's belief that she doesn't have to transmit it to the Senate is one that the Senate welcomes. They don't want it either. They want to keep doing what they're doing.
Jamal, do you agree?
Well, you know who does want it is Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump is someone who's very eager to be what he would call acquitted by the Senate. And the longer this draws out, it just seems the more it gets under Donald Trump's skin. Listen, the Democrats want it to be soon. They also want it to be legit. And if the president's going to go through this process, he should want it to be legit also. Not calling witnesses would be something I think most Americans would think is not a fair trial.
Jamal, I want to finally turn to what's happening in the 2020 race just overall. And there's a CBS poll this week that shows Bernie Sanders leading in New Hampshire in a three-way tie with Biden and Buttigieg in Iowa. As you look at that, what does that mean for the candidate who's not really competing in the early states, but we see his ads now all the time, and that would be Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire former mayor of New York City?
You know, I have a suspicion that Mike Bloomberg is running a super PAC in drag. It's a super PAC disguised as a presidential campaign because he is in states where no other Democrats can afford to be. He is prosecuting a case about centrist Democratic values in contrast to the president of the United States, who is his clear opponent. And he is hiring staff and committing that they will be on payroll through the end of the year on the ground in a bunch of these states. I just think he has Donald Trump in his sights. He's going to do whatever it takes to take out Donald Trump. And if that means he gets to be president of the United States, so much the better.
And he will not be on stage next Tuesday night at the next debate, which will be in Iowa. There's just a few weeks left until the Iowa caucuses, but the candidates who will be on that stage are, so far, Biden, Sanders, Buttigieg, Warren, and Klobuchar. Political strategist Matt Mikowiak and Jamal Simmons, thanks so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump confirmed today that there were no Americans or Iraqis killed in that Iranian missile strike on two military bases in Iraq. Speaking today in the White House, Trump said Iran appears to be standing down and declined to outline any further military action against Iran.
As we continue to evaluate options in response to Iranian aggression, the United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime. These powerful sanctions will remain until Iran changes its behavior.
Let's bring in NPR's Tamara Keith. She's at the White House. And Tamara, Iran's attack was, of course, in retaliation to the killing of top Iranian general Qassem Soleimani. But it sounds like, based on what the president said today, that he has decided not to further escalate this military confrontation. What else is the White House saying today about that attack at those military bases in Iraq?
You know, what is remarkable here is just how much President Trump has vacillated between sort of this tough guy approach and then being very conciliatory. And today it's all about being conciliatory. Just a few days ago, last Saturday, he tweeted this warning to Iran that if it struck U.S. Sites, assets, or Americans, if they were hit, that Iran would be hit very fast and very hard. Well, today he is now saying that he wants peace and that he sees Iran as standing down. I think that he and other U.S. officials are reading into this missile strike, these strikes from Iran, that although it although they did go after American-related sites, they did not kill Americans, and there is a sense that it may have been on purpose.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that he did announce, which was the economic sanctions on Iran. What more do we know about that decision and how this will be received in Iran?
You know, this is not the first time, obviously, President Trump has imposed sanctions. He also imposed sanctions, economic sanctions, after that attack on a Saudi oil facilities. So he has at times responded to military aggression with a non-military response, with an economic response. And this is part of his maximum pressure campaign against Iran to try to get Iran to come to the table to talk about its nuclear program. Of course, President Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. Now, in his remarks today, he's saying the whole, you know, Europe, all these other people that were part of the Iran nuclear deal, you should pull out of it, too. And then we should all get together and negotiate something new.
Yeah, with the little time I have with you, let's talk about the optics of this announcement. Trump was flanked by Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and military leaders. What message do you think the White House is trying to send, of course, being able to get to the table with Iran?
Yeah, you know, I was in the room looking at this scene, and they had such stone faces. There was not a movement in their faces. All of these people behind Trump sort of sending this signal of, you know, American military might.
That's NPR's White House correspondent, Tamara Keith. As always, Tamara, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good to talk with you.
Last month, the Food and Drug Administration approved the world's first vaccine to fight Ebola. Ervebo protects against the virus that is responsible for ravaging entire swaths of communities in Africa. More than 2,000 deaths have been reported in the Democratic Republic of the Congo since 2018. Helen Branswell has been covering this for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
When can we expect large amounts of vaccines to be available in places like the DRC, the Sierra Leone, and Guinea? Who gets access to it?
This vaccine has been used in the current outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo in large amounts, actually. As of yesterday, over 262,000 people in the outbreak have been vaccinated. In terms of other countries that have had Ebola outbreaks in the past, you know, there's no immediate plan to roll out this vaccine. The thing about Ebola is it breaks out sporadically. You don't know where it's going to break out, although there's sort of a band of countries through Central Africa that seem to be home to the bats that probably transmit this virus. But there's no real notion at this point that you would widely vaccinate people across that belt. And it would be really expensive to vaccinate a whole bunch of people against a pathogen that they might never see. So that's not likely the way this vaccine is going to be used. Instead, it will be used when there is an outbreak. And it will likely be used by researchers who work with the Ebola virus and who would very much like to be protected.
That makes sense. Can you remind us how Ebola is spread, where it comes from? And will this vaccine work on an already infected person?
The source of Ebola hasn't been, you know, 100% proven, but there seems to be little doubt that it comes from some kinds of bats and works its way to people either because somebody has an encounter with a bat. In some places, bats are eaten, and so that might be a route of transmission. Or primates in the jungle can become infected with, you know, having had encounters with bats. And then it spreads from person to person by people looking after somebody who's sick. So it's really impossible at this point to tell whether or not the vaccine is effective as a post-exposure treatment. But there is some interesting data from the WHO, which is overseeing the use of the vaccine in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. What they've found is that people who were vaccinated and then later went on to develop disease, they were much less likely to die than people who hadn't been vaccinated. So it could be that the you know, if the vaccine hasn't prevented infection in those cases, that it gives them a leg up and it helps their body develop an immune response to the virus that just, you know, increases their survival chances.
Mm-hmm. In southeastern Guinea, the vaccine trial had been found to be effective. Is that correct?
Yes.
But this study produced backlash, right? Both in the findings and the approach were critiqued. Why?
You know, some people in science really think that only randomized controlled trials can give you a good answer. They do not like things that are called adaptive design trials, which is what the ring vaccination was. And so, you know, there are people who really are not convinced that the design of that trial led to an answer that can be believed.
That's Helen Branswell. She's with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine Publication. Helen, thank you.
Thank you.
And there's some good news from cancer researchers today. A new study by the American Cancer Society shows a 29% decrease in cancer deaths between 1991 and 2017. That means nearly 3 million fewer deaths in the United States than there would have been had rates remained at their peak. Rebecca Siegel is the scientific director of surveillance research for the American Cancer Society. She's lead author on a new study in CA, a cancer journal for clinicians. She joins us now from Atlanta. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is remarkable news. Can you start by telling us, are these rates across the board, or are there particular cancers where the survival rates are improving?
Well, we found that there's a continuing decline in the cancer death rate, and not only has the decline continued, but there was the largest ever single-year drop from 2016 to 2017 of 2.2%. And that is indeed really driven by progress for lung cancer. About 10 years ago, death rates for lung cancer were declining by about 2% per year. But over the past 5 years, they've declined by 4% per year. It's just so exciting because lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer death.
Ah, let's talk a little bit more. Let's delve into those numbers. A 51% decline in lung cancer deaths among men since the peak in 1990. And as you mentioned, a 26% decline in women since 2002. Does this have to do with fewer diagnoses as smoking rates decline, or is it all about the treatment?
It's really driven by smoking. Although since 2000, there have been improvements in treatment across the board for lung cancer, from better surgical techniques to improved drug therapies. And that's now being reflected in improvements in survival across the board for every stage of lung cancer diagnosis.
Breast cancer and prostate cancer deaths also declined. 40% fewer breast cancer deaths among women and 52% fewer prostate cancer deaths among men. Is some of that because of aggressive prevention measures like mammograms and preventive exams?
For breast cancer, it's due to both about equally. For prostate cancer, a lot of the rapid declines are due also to improvements in treatment and to earlier detection because of PSA testing. But in recent years, we've seen prostate cancer mortality flatten out. And a lot of people are, researchers are watching that closely because there's actually been an increase in the number of men being diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer.
What does that tell you? Do you have any insight into potentially why you're seeing those numbers?
It's probably because of the big drop in the use of the PSA test to screen men for prostate cancer. Although PSA testing was contributing to declines in prostate cancer mortality, it was also diagnosing a lot of men with prostate cancer that would never have gone on to cause them harm.
Oh.
And so recommendations were changed, and men are no longer recommended to get routine PSA testing. But unfortunately, that's also resulted in an increase in the diagnosis of distant stage disease now.
Oh, that's so interesting. Obviously, there's still a lot of work to do. You mentioned some of the cancers that are the most prevalent, but what are the cancers where the death rates remain the highest?
Well, the death rate remains the highest for lung cancer. So it's still important to keep an eye on lung cancer and continue to encourage people who smoke to stop smoking, and also to ensure that our young folks aren't starting smoking. Another concern might be the vaping and whether that could be a gateway into the use of other tobacco products.
And those are, of course, preventative measures. But is there something that patients can do, a recommendation you have, to give people a higher chance of increasing their own survival rates when they are diagnosed with cancer?
Absolutely. There are many cancer types where screening can reduce mortality and improve your outcomes. So that would be something that you would do actually before the diagnosis, but make sure that you're following all of your doctor's recommendations for cancer screening, particularly colorectal cancer and cervical cancer, because screening for those cancers can actually prevent disease, but also using the help of patient navigators. Sometimes health systems are really difficult to navigate, and so taking advantage of all of offered services to help you get the care you need once you do have a diagnosis.
We've been talking with Rebecca Siegel, the Scientific Director of Surveillance Research at the American Cancer Society. She's lead author on a new study showing dramatic declines in cancer mortality rates over the last two decades. Thank you so much for sharing this information with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
President Trump says Iran appears to be standing down after striking two bases in Iraq where American troops are based. The Iranian strikes were in retaliation for the U.S. killing of Iran's top military commander in Iraq last Friday.
Iran has been the leading sponsor of terrorism, and their pursuit of nuclear weapons threatens the civilized world. We will never let that happen.
Joining us now is retired Major General Paul Eaton, who supervised the training of Iraqi forces after the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. General Eaton, welcome back.
Jeremy, thank you very much.
And what do you think the goal of these Iranian missile strikes was, since it appears there were not any casualties?
In the military, we call that a demonstration. It is an indication of intent, but it is not an irrevocable action that would precipitate a counterstrike that would be potentially devastating. So it's we're here. We're letting you know that we're very unhappy. And the outcome could go higher. But right now, we're just letting you know that we can respond.
Do you think that an action like that demands a response or not?
Definitely no response required. Each party has indicated violent intent on the part of the United States. It was a devastating blow against Iranian leadership. The Iranians have taken a very appropriate response. The leadership indicated that that was their intent, but we should definitely not respond, certainly not if we wish to keep a reasonable position in our greater alliances.
What do you think that this means for Iraq, where you served, and again, you supervised the training of Iraqi forces after the invasion in 2003? This puts Iraq in a very difficult position, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Jeremy, Iran and Iraq share a long common border. I have walked parts of that border. Iraq is vulnerable politically, militarily, and economically. And their proximate threat, Iran, is very active in all three of those arenas. And they need to balance what they do with the United States with their neighbor. And they're walking a very thin line here, given the fact that 80% of their population is Muslim, and 60% of their population is Shia. Mm-hmm. So the religious alliance is a weighty event.
Do you think that it puts pressure, more pressure, on the United States to pull the remaining troops out of Iraq? As you know, the Iraqi parliament has voted unanimously that the United States should remove its troops from Iraq. But do you think that this latest missile strike will make it more likely that the U.S. leaves entirely?
I do not believe that the U.S. should leave entirely. Wherever we have relatively small numbers of ground forces, there is a very positive effect, a very positive outcome from the influence of those forces. I believe that it would be a mistake for Iraq. I believe it would be a mistake for the United States to withdraw our forces.
General Eaton, one more question. Given what is going on right now, and as you look back on the war in Iraq from 2003, do you think that the United States has achieved anything out of having that invasion and that war in 2003, given where we are now?
Great question, Jeremy. Given the fact that our sons and daughter and I have served over there, the decision to go into Iraq in 2003 was a terrible, terrible decision. So given the fact that I recognize that we made a mistake going in, what we have achieved slowly and very much questionable success is the introduction of a greater Western approach to leadership and governance. But it's not taking hold quickly. It took the Brits over 200 years to create the marvelous state of India. And India is such a complicated country, far more complicated than what we see in Iraq and in the Middle East. But is it worth it? Yes. In the end, in the long history approach to analysis, some 200 years forward, I believe that we have injected American values. And hope is not a method, but I do really hope that that it takes hold, because I believe that we're on the right side of history.
That is retired Army Major General Paul Eaton, who supervised the training of Iraqi forces after the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. He is now a senior advisor to the group Vote Vets. General, thank you so much for joining us.
Indeed, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.